I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. It's a call-in show on how our environment shapes our thoughts and actions. Has a color ever driven you crazy? Who and what makes you feel safe? Why do we mimic one another? And are we better behaved if we think someone is watching? How is your unconscious mind at work responding to the cues all around you all the time? You're about to learn how and to know when it's happening. We'll open the phones for your stories. First, my guest, Adam Alter, on the faculty at NY University. He's lectured at Yale, Stanford, Harvard, University of Chicago, and more. His book is called Drunk Tank Pink, a look at how unexpected forces shape how we think, feel, and behave. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Faith. Good to be on the show.
Me too. Your book title, Drunk Tank Pink, is about the way color affects us. What did researchers learn about this color pink?
So in the late 70s and early 80s, researchers became very interested in how colors affected our behavior in a number of different domains. They started by looking at what happened when you painted school walls different colors. They wanted to see whether they could reduce truancy rates, for example. And they found that one of the colors that worked particularly well was this bright shade of Pepto-Bismol bright bubblegum pink. And the reason it acquired the name Drunk Tank Pink was because soon after they gave some lectures on the color, and some naval prison officers started to paint the inside of jail cells that same color in the jails at the prisons. And they basically found that when the prisoners went into these cells, they came out 15 minutes later much, much calmer. And so it became quite famous for a little while in the early 80s and turned out to be, according to a lot of stories, quite effective at calming people down.
So to what degree, if you're a skeptic, you're looking at this research and you're saying on the face of it, oh, it's very catchy. It's the kind of thing that goes around online a lot.
Right.
And yet this study, I have to say, was repeated over and over and over again. But I wonder, of course, as a skeptic, whether we aren't projecting behavior onto this.
I think you're right. And in fact, a lot of the studies that try to replicate the effect struggled to do that. Even the people who ran the original studies found that it was sometimes difficult to replicate the effect. And other people argued that the effect arose, but not for the reason that people thought. So it may be that the color pink does something to us and has some sort of physiological effect. Another alternative, perhaps, is that we expect certain things when we see the color pink, and it has certain associations for us. And so we think of pink as being perhaps associated with weakness or with other traits that are not associated with strength, and so we become slightly weaker when we see the color. So I think you're right. I think there's good reason to be skeptical about it.
We're going to come back to color in a little bit. Let's talk about names. This is how you open your book. You talk about Carl Jung. You talk about Freud. You talk about Adler. The significance of names for people.
Yeah, names, I think, are incredibly powerful. They're often the first thing you learn about a person who you haven't met before. They're the first piece of information you come into contact with. And I've done a lot of research myself on looking at how names end up shaping all sorts of outcomes. We've looked, for example, at how when you first meet a person, how learning their name as a simple name or as a complex name influences how you feel about them. We've looked at how lawyers progress up the legal hierarchy depending on how simple or complex their names are. And we've also looked not just at the simplicity of the name, but also the sorts of information you can get from names. So there just happen to be some sounds in the English language that make us think either of masculinity or femininity. There was a very famous study done in the 1930s where people were asked to look at two shapes. One of the shapes was sort of like a cloud. It was very rounded. And the other shape next to it was very jagged. Mm-hmm. And people were asked, which of these shapes do you think is called a maluma? And which of these shapes do you think is called a tachetti? And you can tell immediately, and almost everyone agrees, that the maluma is the rounded cloud shape, tachetti is the jagged shape. And there's some fascinating evidence recently that naming someone with a name that's more like tachetti or more like maluma shapes their outcomes. So if you look in South Carolina, a study was done to look at how lawyers progressed up the chain, and they found that more women became judges if they had names that were more like tachetti, more masculine, jagged names, than if they had these rounded names. So it really does go on to influence all sorts of outcomes.
Yeah, the two economists did this study with job applicants, didn't they?
Yes, yes, they did. So that was looking at the effects of the race associated with a particular name. They sent out applications that were, some of them were very strong applications, some of them were weaker applications, and they varied the name that was attached to the application. Now, nothing else really changed. It was just whether the name was associated with a typically black name or a typically white name, and they found that when the application was weak, there wasn't much difference, but when the application was strong, the white applicants got callbacks much more often than the people who had than the same application when it was associated with a typically black name. So names are very powerful.
Also, in this name department, one of the people you studied said that people prefer letters that populate their own names, and that this can go so far that people donate to charities for a variety of reasons, but one of them, very powerful, they donate more often to causes and more generously if the cause shares their initials.
Yeah, it's a striking effect. It's one of the effects that I find most interesting, and I think it has serious implications. So the study you refer to was conducted in Belgium by a Belgian psychologist, Joseph Nutin. There's a couple done in the 80s and 90s. He asked people to circle the six letters that they liked the most in the alphabet. And he did this actually across a whole series of different languages, not just with the English alphabet, with lots of others. And he consistently found that people were about 50% more likely to circle the letter that was their first initial, or the letters of their first initials in their first and second name. And that has all sorts of effects, and the one that you refer to is that people are more likely to donate to charities for hurricanes that share their first initial. So after Hurricane Katrina, someone named Kim or Ken was more likely to donate to that hurricane than they would have been to, say, Hurricane Mitch. And for Hurricane Mitch, someone named Michael or Matt or Millie would have been more likely to donate to that hurricane.
What in the world is going on in the human brain that would make that happen?
Yeah, there are a number of possibilities. I think the one possibility is that people just feel slightly more positive about something when it appeals to that part of their identity. So we generally have positive feelings about ourselves. That's sort of a general human trait. And when that's true, anything that appeals to those positive feelings is seen slightly more favorably. So it's possible that when you hear an appeal, just by having that extra bit of identity or identification with the appeal, you're more likely to donate. Another alternative is that our attention is sort of competed for by all sorts of different cues constantly. And one possibility, and this stretches all the way back to research looking at what's called the cocktail party effect, is that we're just more sensitive to pieces of information that have some sort of personal relevance. And one piece of information, although it's a very thin piece of information, is a name that happens to share our initial. And we know that from the Nutan studies that resonates for us, that's very important to us. And so it's possible that we just attend a little bit more closely and therefore are more likely to donate to a charity when the hurricane shares our initial.
Mm. I know you and your colleague Danny Oppenheimer, who's a psychology professor at Princeton, you looked at the stock market and learned that when stocks are new, these young stocks, they do better on the market when their names are easy to pronounce.
Yes, that's right. And it is important to note that it is for these newer stocks. So again, just as you meet someone and you don't know that much about them and the name means a lot then, the same is true for a stock that you've essentially never met before. It's a new stock that enters the market. You don't know that much about it. You're trying to glean as much information as possible. And the one thing you keep doing is you repeat the name, you think about the name a lot. And we know from a lot of research that people feel generally more positive about things in the environment that are easier to process. As a species, humans like to process things as only as deeply as they absolutely have to. And so if they can rely on shallower processing, they will do that because so much is constantly competing for our attention. And so if a stock doesn't force you to think too hard, just as a person doesn't force you to think too hard about their name, we feel just ever so slightly more positive about that stock or that person. And the argument we make in that case, and it's since been replicated in at least half a dozen markets around the world, is that these stocks do slightly better because A, we like them slightly more, and B, because that liking translates into a sense of value or promise.
There's something interesting that happens also in terms of what we see. We're this world is flat now. We all come in so many colors, especially in major cities, all mixing together. And you said that when Tiger Woods was on Oprah's show, she asked him whether he considered himself black, and he said he was Cablan Asian.
Yes, Cablan Asian, exactly.
And so that stands, that's a portmanteau word, and it combines Caucasian, black, Native American, and Asian all together.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's absolutely true, and I think in a world where we are becoming more and more exposed to names from different cultures, I think one thing that's certainly happening is that we're getting better able to deal with the complexities associated with different languages. So for a very long time, anything that was foreign was very, very difficult for us to handle. And one of the arguments I make that continues through the book into a number of other different chapters is that because of globalization, because it's easier to travel now, because of the internet, because of our exposure to foreign cultures, we're becoming exposed to more and more beyond the home culture that we tend to associate with more often or most often. And that's actually making us better able to deal with, say, the disfluency of foreign names. And so hopefully across time, some of these effects are likely to diminish.
Well, labels. We're getting into this area now of the labels we put on things. You quote a study in your book, Drunk Tank Pink, about what happened when they labeled in a test, they labeled a group of kids academic bloomers. And if the teachers thought these kids were academic bloomers, well, something happened to these kids and their test scores.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So this was a study done about half a century ago now, and it's an absolute classic in the world of social psychology. And these kids took an IQ test, and this was at the beginning of the year, and some of them were randomly selected to be described as bloomers. Now, these kids had not actually done any better on the test. Their scores were absolutely indistinguishable from the kids who were not labeled bloomers. But they were picked out from the group at large for no particular reason, completely at random, and then they were placed into a different class, a special accelerated class at the school they were at. We've actually never learned the identity of that school. It was given a pseudonym, the Oak School. And they were placed in this other class. The teachers who were teaching them were told, just so you know, in your care here, you have some very special students. They may not be blossoming yet, but we've done some tests on them, and we have decided that they are bloomers. So they were given this label suggesting that they would flourish into something fantastic that they hadn't perhaps reached yet but would happen soon. And what they found was the teachers devoted more attention, more time, and more energy to them. And by the end of the year, they had scored on various tests 10 to 15 IQ points higher. And that was by virtue alone of the fact that they'd been given that label. They were actually no different from the other students. But just by having that label, they attracted slightly different forms of attention from the teachers. And perhaps when they didn't perform very well, or as well as they might, the teacher said things like, you know what, the overarching label that they've been given is that they're bloomers. Even bloomers experience difficulty sometimes. That's probably not a good indication of their general progress, and so they maintain that promise, that sense of promise. Whereas you could imagine for a child who's given a different label, like a struggler, someone who's not doing as well, you could imagine any sign that the person is struggling in any domain might be interpreted very differently, that this is just sort of generally indicative of their general tendency to struggle with academic work.
So expectations, people rise to expectations. There's an interesting lesson in that. You also, on the other side of the equation, talk about the colleague of Sigmund Freud's who had this pet diagnosis of hysteria. And so pretty much all the female patients who came to see him were getting this label. And this persists today, as women with any complaint being seen as hysterics.
Yeah, exactly. This is a big problem. This is Jean Charcot, and he was one of Sigmund Freud's mentors, and he used this label hysteria to describe an incredibly broad array of symptoms. And of course, that happens to some extent today with a number of disorders. And what ends up happening is you'll find that a patient will go to a psychiatrist, and if the label is sufficiently broad, it might be the case that even behavior that really shouldn't be considered to be pathological ends up being bound up within that too broad label, that excessively broad label, and that's obviously very damaging.
So this is how we see that labels, names, color pull us in directions that we're conscious of and unconscious about. Adam Alter is my guest. He's author of Drunk Tank Pink. He's at New York University, and he continues with us after a short break. Please join us with a story if you hear something that triggers an idea. 203-776-9677. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. It's great to have you listening. My guest is Adam Alter of New York University, author of Drunk Tank Pink, about how unexpected forces around us shape how we think, feel, and behave. The wise thing is to know what's in play because you're... You know, we're rats in a maze to some degree. So it's interesting and smart to know what's working behind the scenes. I want to talk with you, Adam, about the super symbols. Mm-hmm. Because you have a section in the book on all kinds of symbols. And one of the super symbols, of course, is money. It's probably one of the most powerful. And I mean monetary currency.
Yeah, it is a very powerful symbol. It influences an incredible array of behaviors, of thoughts, of feelings. And it's not surprising given what money represents in our society. In fact, there's even some research that shows that when you watch money being destroyed, I talk about an anecdote that a pop group in the UK that, called the KLF in the early 90s, they were awarded £1 million as a reward for some work they had done. And they decided that... As artists, they would burn the money, and they went to a shed in Scotland, in one of the islands off Scotland, off the coast of Scotland, and they burned this £1 million. And a journalist was allowed to watch and then write about the experience, and he described the pain he felt as he watched this money going up in smoke and in flames. And you can just imagine that. And when you look at people's brains when they watch money being destroyed, their brains almost respond as though they're experiencing physical pain. It's hard to distinguish the responses. And money is therefore, as you can tell from that example, just incredibly powerful for us. When we're exposed to money, we behave very differently. One of the things we do is we unfortunately become a little bit less helpful towards other people. So there are some great studies where people were incidentally exposed to some money. Either they happened to look at a poster of some currency, or they had to count money. And after that, when they encountered someone in a hallway, that person dropped a series of pencils on the floor. And that person was obviously asked to do that ahead of time. And what the researchers found was that people who had seen money beforehand were just a little bit less helpful. They were less likely to help pick up the pencils and to help this person after the slight mishap.
And why is that?
Well, the argument is that... money makes us, or at least we associate money with being independent, and perhaps being a little bit less dependent on other people makes us also slightly more selfish. We know from other studies, for example, that one thing that happens when people see money is they become less likely to ask for help. So it's not just that we become less willing to offer help, but if you give people a very, very difficult task and you ask them to sit in a room and to complete the task as best they can, but you also tell them, if you struggle, just come down the hall and we'll be able to get someone to help you. They are much less likely to come down the hall, or they will wait much longer if the task stumps them, if they've seen money beforehand.
When you're talking about the artists, the two artists who burned all that money, you point out in the book that they could have fed almost 1 million Rwandans.
Yes.
Or people in their own country. And so it's amazing what that triggers in me, the kind of revulsion I feel. I when I hear that story, I think to myself, really, you couldn't have found another way to get that point across.
Yeah, I agree, absolutely. And they were obviously well aware of the effect they were having. It's precisely why they did what they did. And I point out in the book, as you said, they could have fed 800,000 starving Rwandans or housed 68 homeless families in London for a year and so on. So that money means a lot to people, and I think that's why it derives, or where it derives its power, that it has the power to do so much. The possibilities are endless, and you can generate those possibilities without trying very hard. And so watching money squandered or seeing signs of money is very powerful for that reason.
So far, we've looked at names, we've looked at labels, and we've looked at symbols. We're going to get into the mere presence of other people with Adam Alter, my guest from New York University's author of this book, Drunk Tank Pink, and it's about how unexpected forces around us shape how we think, feel, and behave. Why did you do this book? Why do you want us to think about these things?
I think for two reasons. The first reason is I think it's intrinsically very interesting stuff. I think understanding why we behave the way we do, why we think the way we do, what makes us think, how we reach the conclusions we reach, I think is a very interesting question, and I think it's something that a lot of people are interested in. That's the first reason, just because it's intrinsically interesting to me, and I imagined it would be to other people. Mm-hmm. I think the second reason, though, is this stuff is very, very powerful, and understanding it allows us to run our lives, I think, a little bit more effectively and efficiently, and we might be more happy as a result. And even for policymakers, there are a lot of effects in here that might make us better off. We talked earlier about the effects of names on hurricanes, on hurricane donation aid, and I did a small calculation that turns out many more Americans have names that begin with the letters J and M than other letters, for example. Now, the way we name hurricanes today is that we pick names that go down the alphabet, that run through the alphabet. And this is something that the National Weather Service has done since the 1950s. There's nothing inherently wrong with that approach, but there's also nothing inherently right about it. It's just a random approach that samples from letters across the alphabet or names across the alphabet. In the book, I suggest that if you were more strategic about it, or if the Weather Service were more strategic about it, since people are more likely to donate to hurricane aid charities that happen to share their initials, it makes sense to pick more names with M's that begin with M or J or the letter A, for example. And instead of having Hurricane Ophelia or Hurricane Van, which we have in the next few years, it makes far more sense to have a couple of extra M names or J names. And in fact, we could raise, over the last 10 years, I did a small calculation, we could have raised an extra $700 million in hurricane aid. So I think there are real practical consequences here. These are inexpensive interventions, but they have dramatic consequences.
Yeah, isn't that so interesting? It makes me think, if a hurricane looks like it has a certain strength, maybe that's the time to go with the most powerful letters.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I hadn't thought of that, but absolutely. I mean, you don't need to name the hurricane far in advance. It only gets its name once it becomes a tropical storm, and so with forecasts, we really could optimize the situation, I think, far better than we do.
You get into the power of other people, their mere presence. And there's a study that you talk about where when people were stealing and putting up the image of a pair of eyes made people behave better, because even that symbol of eyes made people feel as if they were being watched. And these were basically honest people.
Exactly, yes. Speaking of inexpensive interventions that have dramatic consequences, it doesn't take real surveillance to get people to behave better. And obviously one of the big questions in crime and punishment and in the legal system is, how do we deal with the fact that crime is widespread? It's hard to predict where and when it will happen. And these people obviously weren't committing grave crimes. They were just people who happened to be working in a psychology department at a university in Newcastle in the UK. And as a lot of people tend to do, they weren't 100% honest about paying for the tea and coffee that they were taking from the tea room at the university, at the department. And so some researchers got curious about the idea that we may not need to have real surveillance to feel that we're being watched. And being watched is a very powerful effect or a powerful experience. And so every week for 10 weeks, they varied a picture that they stuck just above the honesty box, where they were asking people to contribute just a few pence whenever they took tea, coffee, or milk. And they varied the picture. Some weeks it was a pair of eyes that were either human eyes or humanoid eyes that looked like human eyes. And other weeks they were things like flowers. And if you look in the book, you'll see the effect of this intervention was dramatic, that on weeks when they showed flowers, people were dishonest, as they had been generally. But just by changing that picture to a pair of eyes, which costs nothing, they increased the amount that people were donating from 15 pence per litre to 42 pence per litre, so almost three times as much. So there were, another way of phrasing it is, people were effectively three times as honest in their behavior when the picture was a pair of eyes, of human eyes, that sense that they were being watched, rather than a pair of rather than some flowers.
So, Adam, it made me wonder what would happen if one of these major diet programs that operates coast to coast in this country had this pair of eyes as a sort of device, and you put it on the refrigerator, and the slogan under it said, "We're watching out for you," and they would know every time you went into the refrigerator. I wonder if it would cause people to eat less.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I've made the suggestion to people before. They say, you know, I have this one cupboard where I have chocolates, and I try not to eat too many chocolates. And one of the suggestions I make, which also comes from the book, is if you stick a small mirror in that cupboard, every time you open it, you will be greeted with your own eyes. And there is no pair of eyes that peers deeper into the soul than our own. Mirrors are very powerful for that reason. And so if you're looking at your own eyes every time you're about to reach for a chocolate bar, you might think twice before doing that.
There's this section when you talk about the mere presence of other people. And it's the chameleon effect, if you listen to psychologists. This tendency we have, even infants do this, to mimic the other person in the room.
Yeah, we do it instinctively, and it does happen from a very young age. People describe humans as animals like any other, but we're distinguished from other animals in a number of ways. And one of the main ways is that we're very, very social. Or sociable, and we're very interested in affiliation in ways that a lot of other animals aren't. And we're so driven by that tendency towards affiliation that we end up mimicking other people in an attempt to encourage them to like us. And there's a lot of fascinating research that looks at this effect, and one of the studies, people were speaking to a research, an experimenter, and they were sitting in chairs across from one another. And a video camera filmed this whole thing unobtrusively, and the experimenter was instructed to do certain things, either to touch his or her face or to tap his or her feet. And without realizing it, the person who happened to be sitting across from them did exactly the same thing, or was much more likely to do the same thing.
I'm sorry, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and we really have no idea that we're doing this.
This raises the issue of, say, social responsibility of filmmakers, for instance. If they're showing scenes, people driving wildly through cities in chases without a seatbelt on, or smoking, or doing something that might cause harm in a public responsibility sort of way, what is their responsibility to everybody else by showing these images if you think people are going to mimic this behavior, the copycat effect?
Yeah, the copycat effect, I think it's a slightly different effect from the effect that we were talking about earlier, the chameleon effect. The chameleon effect is a very low-level effect, and it's really just about low-level mimicry. I think when filmmakers show behaviors like smoking on TV or driving badly, or when car advertisements show someone driving the car extremely fast, I think that what that does is something a little bit high level, a little bit more high level, that sets the norms differently. And I think that's slightly less subtle, but every bit as powerful, if not more so. I think they operate on slightly different levels. One is a much more subtle, unconscious effect. The other, to some extent, sets different norms and drives behavior that way. But I think you're absolutely right. I do think filmmakers and advertisers have a real duty to make sure that the things that they're sending out there aren't encouraging the wrong kinds of copycat effects.
This is Adam Alter of New York University's author of Drunk Tank Pink, and it's about how unexpected forces around us shape how we think, feel, and behave. If you feel that you have ever been directed to some action because of a cue that you were aware of or not aware of, call and tell us a story, 203-776-9677. What are those powerful influences around you or that make you stop and think, you know, why did I do that? In terms of mimicking, you made me think, Adam, about those, remember the laughing clubs where people were, they were in Japan, I think. Isn't that where they started, where people would just show up together? And the idea was you just sat around for half an hour and somebody would start and you would just laugh. And the idea was to stimulate those chemicals within the body and have a positive effect. And once a couple of people started laughing, everybody would laugh.
Yeah, laughter, like yawning, is incredibly contagious. It's another one of those human effects, those things that we do as humans that really transmits very rapidly across a crowd. And so those clubs did capitalize on exactly that, the idea that when a couple of people laugh, others laugh around them, and that releases endorphins, and it's an incredibly powerful form of treatment.
We're going to talk about the characteristics of other people. We're at 203-776-9677 if you have a question for Adam Alter. You have this category, the characteristics of other people. We made a reference to it earlier when we talked about how Tiger Woods identifies himself. The fact that we now have an African-American, self-identified African-American president. There is this fear of difference, as you point out, that is deeply ingrained in us. It seems like it's almost wired in us. And the question is, as Rodney King said, how do we all get along in a world where our brains operate that way and where we teach each other this behavior?
Yeah, it's probably one of the most unfortunate or distressing parts of the book for me, this idea that this xenophobia, this fear of what's different, is so deeply ingrained, and it's something that is difficult to overcome. A big part of that, I think, is in changing what seems to be part of the out-group. So if we're becoming more and more exposed, as the Tiger Woods example showed, the more we're exposed to these foreign groups or out-groups or minority groups, the better we seem to be able to cope with them and with their presence, and the better we're able to respond to them not as out-groups anymore, but as part of a global or larger superordinate in-group. And I think that makes us better equipped to deal with that.
You also make the case in the book that difference gets translated by us into a threat to personal safety. And that is interesting. I remember when there was even much more homophobia than there is now, and there, you know, people would say to each other, "Well, I'm afraid of gay people because if you were in the bathroom with one, they might attack you." You know, it was that sense of anybody's difference was a physical threat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as far as that goes, if you think about an evolutionary timescale or a much larger timescale, and you think back to what it might have been like many, many thousands of years ago and beyond, I think when you come into contact with something that's familiar to you, that feels familiar, you sort of assume that since it hasn't hurt you in the past, it's familiar, you're coming into contact with it a second or third or however many times you've seen it before. Because it hasn't hurt you in the past, that brings you a sense of comfort. It seems less likely to be a threat to your safety. Something that's new, even if that new thing is positive, or for other reasons is positive, its novelty, just its novelty alone, leads you to just be slightly less sure about what it'll do to you. And that evolutionary effect, that fear that we have about things that are novel, that slight reticence we have, I think does translate into the modern world in ways that are obviously far from adaptive and that bring about all sorts of negative behaviors.
So the more you get to hear about something or you get to know people, the more familiar this seems, and so it doesn't feel like a threat to personal safety. Let's take a call, Adam. Adam Alter, New York University, author of Drunk Tank Pink, and this is about how the unexpected forces around us shape how we think, feel, and behave. David Faith Middleton, welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, I have a couple of observations. I actually taught communication skills at a local community college for more than 30 years. I'm retired now. And one of the things that I noticed in what he was talking about that I think we need to consider, first of all, is that we don't all have the same sensual vocabulary. That when we are, for instance, an artist, a visual artist may have a larger color vocabulary than someone who's not a visual artist. And so we're going to respond to our environments differently as individuals anyway. Although we may respond, it's not going to be across the board. And the other thing is that in groups of people or between two people, there is always an ongoing negotiation about our perception. So that says, in effect, that, for instance, between a teacher and student, students come in with a perception of who they are, what sort of student they are, how they're going to do that year that they've built over a long time. And they start by sending out lots of subtle, mostly non-signals that tell the teacher that's who they are. And the teacher then responds most times by saying, well, that's probably fine with me. It's less, you know, I know who you are now. And then if you give that teacher a signal that says the student is something different, then there's a power differential.
Uh-huh.
And the teacher's power is going to perhaps overcome the perception of the student unless that student has a very powerful self-concept. Mm.
David, I want to give Adam a chance to jump in. Your phone is breaking up just a little bit, so I just don't want to frustrate the listener. A couple words were dropping out. So, Adam, what about the power dynamic in all of this, which is, I think, what David's getting at?
Yeah, I think the power dynamic is significant, and it's a big part of these interactions. David's absolutely right. In this chapter you and I were talking about earlier, where we were talking about the characteristics of different people, I think that comes into a large extent there, that different groups that we come into contact with or different people that we come into contact with are trying to share different pieces of information with us. They're trying to show either that they are more powerful or they're trying to assert their power. And I think that ends up shaping our interactions in all sorts of ways. So I absolutely agree that the factors or the characteristics that define different groups go on to determine the interactions we have with them. That's certainly right.
We're going to talk on the other side of this break about what you discuss in the book. There's a New York company that has sold the power of love in the form of liquid trust. We're going to tell you what that is on the other side of this break. We'll be right back. Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. We're on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Adam Alter is my guest, New York University author of Drunk Tank Pink, a very interesting book about how unexpected forces around us shape how we think, feel, and behave. John, Faith Middleton, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I love your show.
Thank you. Oh, my goodness. Thank you.
And I was wondering about the sense of smell and how that might affect us. And I'll just give you one little example. I always wear Old Spice. And I've had so many of my clients say to me over the years, you smell just like my father used to.
Hmm. So you're associated with the familiar. So, Adam, what do you think?
Well, sense of smell, people say, is the strongest throwback to past memories. They say that it's more powerful than any of the other senses, which I think is quite fascinating. And you know if you're walking along and you smell something you haven't smelled in, say, 30 years, it'll throw you back to that memory immediately and very powerfully. And so I think that's absolutely right. It does have a very strong effect on reinstating a past context. Another thing that the sense of smell does is it influences, we know from some consumer behavior research, some of our purchasing behavior. And by piping certain smells into stores or into showrooms, mm-hmm. you can actually slightly change how people consume. And so there is some research on the sense of smell and how it affects our thoughts, behaviors, and feelings, but I don't touch on it much in the book, but I think it's absolutely fascinating.
And we know
nothing
this
like the smell of bacon.
Yes, the smell of bacon is a great example.
Faith loves bacon.
This is a frequent listener, I can tell. Thank you.
I smelled it.
Oh, did we lose him? Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess we did. The same is true for sound. We were looking at a study on a food show that I do, Adam, showing that, you know, you wonder why restaurants would jack up music so loud when the place is already thunderous with noise because of the way the place is built. And so why would you add music on top of that and blast it? And all these studies were showing that people's checks rose the louder it got in the place. So they were ordering, I guess we order more in that kind of environment, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's fascinating stuff. And I think it's consistent with a lot of this very intricate consumer behavior research, which shows that the number of factors that influence things like how much we spend, how willing we are to spend, how quickly we make our decisions to spend, those factors are numerous and often very unexpected.
203-776-9677 if you have a question for my guest Adam Alter, author of Drunk Tank Pink. So this New York company creates something called Liquid Trust.
Yeah, company is called Vero Labs, and they have a product they call Liquid Trust, and the active ingredient there is a hormone called oxytocin. Oxytocin is responsible for that bonding that occurs between a mother and her newborn child. And It's been studied a lot recently. It's become a very hot topic, and it's quite controversial. So the company basically claims that if you spray a little bit of liquid trust, people who smell the liquid trust or who inhale it are more likely to trust you. By activating this hormone or by increasing the rate of this hormone inside the body, you make that person more willing to trust, basically. And the reason why it's controversial is because more and more research is being done now, and it's showing that the effects are much more complex than we initially assumed. The initial billing was that this was the hormone of love, that it just made people more willing to love and to trust and to, you know, it brought out all the best sides of human behavior. But there's a lot of research now showing that that's much more complex than that. For example, we know that these are behaviors are true, but especially so for the in-group. We've talked a little bit about in-groups and out-groups and minorities and groups of different race. There were some studies showing that people are, when they inhale oxytocin, they are more trusting of the in-group, but they actually become more distrusting or untrusting of the out-group. And so you get completely the opposite effect. But it is a fascinating product and a fascinating idea. I just don't think we quite understand it well enough at this stage.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder why you would just stop with pink paint on the walls with violent prisoners, or, you know, why not just flood the room with oxytocin?
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, we just don't understand it well enough to know whether that would help or hurt. You could imagine prisoners perceiving their guards as the out group, and therefore becoming even more aggressive in the presence of oxytocin.
Yeah. So there was a UCLA neuroscientist, and he was trying to figure out. I don't know if it was a he or a she, but this scientist was interested in figuring out whether a person could withstand more pain. If you were looking at a picture of a long-term romantic partner, and what happened?
Yeah, and that is basically what they found, she found, was that when you were looking at a picture of a romantic partner, you were able to take a painful heat better than you could if you weren't staring at your partner. And there were a number of different conditions in this study. Some people were staring at a photograph of the loved one, of the partner. Other people were holding the hand of the partner, and they found that really the strongest thing here was staring at the face of your partner. That was one of the most powerful effects. That somehow that photo of the loved one acted as a sort of painkiller.
So it says, as you point out in the book, it in a way it whispers to you that everything is going to be okay.
Yes, exactly. This picture of the loved one has that sensation. It activates parts of the brain that suggest that, signaling safety, the sense that there isn't a risk around. It sort of overrides the experience of pain that you might be experiencing, and it does, in effect, whisper to you that everything is going to be fine.
This makes me try to understand why meditation, Jon Kabat-Zinn, as you know, he started his meditation stress reduction stuff by saying to a hospital, give me the people you can't fix who are in such pain and there's no medicine to help them. I want to work with them. And there was that famous film showing how meditation did help them tremendously tolerate pain. I wonder why.
Yeah, I think meditation is very powerful. I also think it's something that scientists haven't spent as much time studying as they perhaps could or should. And we don't fully understand exactly what goes on with meditation. There are some neuroscientists now at Princeton who have been studying this question for a little while. They've tried to understand, for example, what's different about a monk's brain from the brain of someone else. So someone who meditates frequently, are there fewer signs of stress in their neural activity? And part of it might be the content of what they're thinking about, or perhaps it's even that they aren't thinking about anything in particular, and that relieves us of the stress that affects almost everyone at some point in the day. So there are lots of questions, and I think it's certainly worth exploring further.
Let's come back to color again. And by the way, if you have a call, a thought for Adam Alter or a comment, question, we'd love to hear from you. He's author of Drunk Tank Pink, and this is about how unexpected forces around us shape how we think, feel, and behave. We talked in the beginning, and your book is named Drunk Tank Pink because that color, they learned, I think back in the 80s, was subduing calming to a lot of people. And so the wily drunk in the cell was they started painting everything pink, essentially to calm people down. Well, to come back to color, blue turns out to be incredibly calming.
Blue is calming. It's calming, and it also, we were speaking about ways to make people more honest, inexpensive ways to make people more honest. There is some evidence that the blue light that we associate in many cultures with the police has that effect as well. There are a number of studies showing just that effect, that when blue lights appeared in parts of Glasgow, Glaswegians started to behave a little bit more sedately, a bit more honestly. There was slightly less violent crime. The same thing then happened when some Japanese train stations started to use blue lights. They found the same basic effect. And in some nightclubs now, they're starting to put little blue lights in some of the glasses that people are using to drink from. And they found the same basic effect, that there's slightly less bad behavior when people are exposed to these blue lights.
It makes you think about what colors cities and towns choose to paint certain structures. I mean, is it the cheapest paint they can find? Is it what is the color they choose for the bridges? What are you trying to say about a place? What are you trying to get people to do? To notice? To not notice?
I think a big message in the book is that so many of these decisions are made without much thought. It is because either the paint is slightly cheaper or because it's just the paint that we've used for a dozen years or 100 years. So much of what we do is done without the information that we could have if we looked a little bit further. And so the book tries to gather this information together and to suggest, for example, that default color you've been using to paint your children's room or a bridge in the city or a billboard or whatever it may be, that color choice is actually quite important, and it's certainly worth paying attention to and thinking about before you make those decisions.
You said that some U.S. and Australian states have even banned teachers from correcting academic work with red ink.
Yeah, that's right. This is true in Australia. There was some legislation. They were trying to pass some legislation to ban teachers from using red ink. And that sounds a little bit strange and perhaps a bit extreme. But there is some research showing that when you correct a paper with red ink rather than another color of ink, first of all, the impression that you draw of the work that you're reading is more negative. So having red ink makes you more critical. It also makes it easier to detect errors. So somehow that color red reminds us of correction, perhaps of stopping rather than starting. You know, the color red is associated with stop signs, with warnings. And so all of that puts us in a particular mindset that makes us just a little bit more critical. And so there is some reason perhaps behind that strange policy.
Makes you wonder what gets communicated in terms of color in certain environments. If you're in a medical suite, if you're in the hospital, if you're in a store, in a restaurant, things get communicated by these colors that make you want to stay in place, leave, calming, agitating. It seems best to be very careful about this.
Yeah, it's a morass. That's one of the problems, that in different contexts, different colors will have different effects. So the same color red that makes you more critical in one context, if you're online dating, we know that people are more successful when they wear red shirts. And so that same color red brings about great outcomes in the world of online dating, but less positive outcomes in the world of academic grading. And it's very important not just to understand the color itself and what people assume when they see the color, but also how that color interacts with the particular setting.
And to come full circle, be very careful what you name your child.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Very, very important to be careful what you name your child. Lawyers are more likely to become partners more quickly with a name that's fluent, that's easy to process. And in general, I think it certainly pays to pay attention to that sort of thing.
And Adam, all about morality. Thank you so much. Adam Alter, author of Drunk Tank Pink and on the faculty at New York University. As always, this show is about the richness of life. Thanks to producers Jonathan McNichol and Lori Mack. Production assistance from Josh Allen. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.